Digital Migration Podcast, second episode, Digital Migration, a look at the Schengen Information System. Welcome to the Digital Migration Podcast, an initiative of the line of research on migration and digital transformation of Nova Refugee Clinic, Legal Clinic. Our group is composed by
Emeline de Oliveira, Inês Freire dos Santos,
Priscila Azevedo,
Victoria Costa.
Peace alignment, and I have the honor of chairing this episode, which will feature two distinguished guests, Professor Julien Jandebeau and Professor Evelyn Brouwer. Thank you both for having accepted our invitation and being here today with us. I would like to start with a question to Brouwer. To contextualize our listeners, I would like you to briefly explain what is the purpose and functioning of the CIS, giving your opinion regarding the necessity for the information collected by the database to safeguard European security.
Thank you very much, Eileen, for the invitation, and Sophia. I'm very happy to be here, and also that you have this podcast on a very important topic, which changes over time, and when I can also beyond the use of the Schengen Information System, there are many other databases which we touch upon shortly during this podcast, and has been changed since I wrote my PhD on the Schengen Information System in 2007. I defended it in the University of Nijmegen. And the Schengen Information System has a long history. It's the oldest large-scale databases containing information on third country nationals, but not only. Also, for example, European arrest warrant, missing children, stolen or missed identity documents. And it has been considered as a compensatory measure for the abolition of internal border controls in the 1990s. So when the Treaty on Schengen was established, it was deemed necessary to establish also a large-scale databases for use by law enforcement authorities and judicial authorities, and aside to that, also by immigration authorities. So it explains that there are different categories of data on personal information. And to be honest, there are about 90 million alerts in the Schengen Information System, but only 1 million of them addresses data on individuals, persons like you and me. And whereas in the beginning, the Schengen states at that time, there were first nine, now there are almost 30 states using this data system. And that explains also why it's so relevant and important that the data should be accurate and precise and legitimate in the Schengen Information System. But only 1 million data is on individuals. And in the beginning, almost 90% concerned third country nationals reported for the purpose of refusal of entry. So inadmissible aliens or unwanted migrants, if you can say so. And from that 90%, now it is maybe 50%. So 500,000 alerts concerns third country nationals, so inadmissible aliens. So still it's a quite important tool. If you're reported in the Schengen Information System, it will tell the border guards, it will tell embassies when you apply for a visa, short-term visa, that you're not allowed to enter the Schengen area, which, as I said, is now more than almost 30 states involved. So the use of the Schengen Information System is quite influential if it concerns the admission and entry of persons. But aside of that, it is also used for European arrest warrant and to find missing children and to help judicial authorities.
Thank you. I would also like to ask Professor Jandebeau, what is it that makes mass data surveillance a sustainable policy option for EU border security?
Thank you very much. And thank you for the invitation, of course. I think just maybe before that, to kind of quickly come back to what Evelyn was saying, one of the recent evolutions of the SIS has been that it is also now used to check the entries and exits of EU citizens, right? So there's been a modification in 2017, and it was in the context of concerns with European citizens going to fight in Syria and Iraq in particular. So technically, today, EU citizens should also be checked when they enter and when they exit, I believe, the territory of the Schengen area. They should be checked against the SIS. Now, in practice, it doesn't happen all the time because there's provisions in the regulation that allows member states not to check systematically third country nationals and mostly EU citizens. But that's an important thing to keep in mind. So SIS has also evolved in that way. Now, for the mass data variance question. So yeah, I'm not sure it's a sustainable policy option, right? So in the sense that it has its viability in the long run, still is an open question. We don't know exactly because there might be court challenges somewhere down the road that might question whether this is actually viable. And there's also technical concerns as to how this is going to work. And I think it's also important that we explain why we call it mass surveillance. What we refer to here is to the fact that we now have multiple, and we will have multiple information systems that involve the processing of personal data for third country nationals in relation to border and migration enforcement. So when we talk about mass surveillance, mass data surveillance, we're first referring to this proliferation. So you have the SIS, but you also have the visa information system, you have Eurodac, and you will have the upcoming entry exit system, the European travel information and authorization system, and all of the interoperability mechanisms. So that's quite a lot that focuses significantly on border and migration enforcement. But it's not necessarily only about the number of systems or the volume of data, but it's also about the fact that it's indiscriminate, right? In the sense that what these systems do mostly is that they systematically collect personal data of third country nationals, irrespective of any particular characteristic or any particular knowledge that you might have of what these third country nationals might be up to. So it's mass data surveillance because it's surveillance through electronic means, so it's data surveillance, but it's also indiscriminate surveillance, and that's one of the kind of question marks here. And lastly, it's not only about it's the indiscriminate nature of this data processing. It's also about the kind of operations that this mass data collection allows you to do. And one of the concerns that I think is really strong at the moment is that with this amount of data, it becomes justifiable and possible to conduct automated processing, right? So what we also call rules-based processing, but it's also called profiling, right? So it becomes possible to say, well, we're not just going to use this data to check, for example, the identity of people who enter the European Union, but we're to make sure that the person who's applied for a visa is indeed the person who shows up at the border. But we're also going to use this data in order to identify individuals that we might not necessarily know about, but that might fit, you know, some characteristics of persons of concern, because you know they're traveling from a specific city because they have a particular nationality, or they were born in a specific place, and so on and so forth. So that's everything that has to do, in fact, you know, what we call mass surveillance. It refers to this whole range of concerns, and now the question of, you know, how this came about, and Evelyn has more to say on this than I do here, I think, as well. It's there's no single reason why this has developed over time. One of the reasons is that, in a way, this is what the EU can do in this area, right? Until very recently, the establishment of the core of Border Guard and the responsibility of Frontex, European Union bodies did not have operational officials, right? Officials capable of being involved in operational settings, being capable of, you know, checking someone's passport or someone's visa and so on and so forth. So what essentially what EU policies were about, they were about sharing and exchanging and analyzing information. And to a large extent, you know, establishing all these databases is one of the few ways that the EU has to say, look, we're doing something when it comes to border enforcement and migration enforcement. And you've had very big services within the Commission, especially within DG Home, that were dealing with this with the development and the deployment of these systems on a daily basis. And now it's EU LISA. So you have, in a way, it's kind of, it's a form of inertia, right? This policy option has never been reconsidered over time or seriously questioned. And, you know, there's other things, of course, but it would be too long, I think, to develop. But over time also, the fact that you have these large systems means that the EU has developed a range of relations with stakeholders, right, in the private sector in particular. So companies and research services that, you know, that do technical research about how to implement these systems, how to upgrade them, but also how to deploy them. So the whole range of contractors that are used by EULISA and the European Commission to do that. So there's a whole ecosystem of actors that have a stake in the continuation of this policy option and that help make it sustainable, which is understandable from a professional perspective, right? You want to continue to do what you're already doing and what you know how to do. Sorry, that was a protracted answer, but I hope it helps a bit.
Thank you. Knowing that CIS2 purposes are different from the purposes of CIS1, I would like to ask Brouwer, what were the changes concerning the storage and the use of data on three country nationals and its practical implications?
Yeah, maybe, thank you. Maybe I can proceed here. What Julien explained already very well, that you have to distinguish perhaps two changes which are huge and very massive for third country nationals trying to travel and to be in Europe, because of this development of databases. First, yes, the Schengen Information System has been amended over time because of this emphasis by EU member states on security, immigration prevention, but also the involving use of technologies. It were also the technologies presenting themselves. So industries saying to border guards, saying to the European Commission, look, this are the technologies you can use, large scale, collection of data, but also risk assessment algorithms and etc. So the Schengen Information System started to change, also of course since 9/11, new emphasis on security. So also the involvement of Europol, the involvement of facial images will be in future used in the Schengen Information System, interconnection. But in general, and that's what Julien already referred to, it is only part of six large-scale databases. So the last 5-10 years, the European legislator developed, aside from the existing Schengen Information System, Eurodac, which we know is used for asylum procedures and the determination of responsible member states. And we have the Visum Information System. It's about 90 million data already entered. We have the entry-exit system, the ATS, and the ECRIS on third country nationals, as Julien mentioned. And the huge amendment is that not only there will be a connection based on the regulation on interoperability, I've just called that for my students in presentations last week, the ring that rules them all. The European Commission wants to make sure that border guards, law enforcement authorities, when they address one person in one system, they can have the possibility to see whether the person is also in another database. So this interoperability uses the whole framework of the existing Schengen Information System, but also connected to all the other large-scale databases, of which three are still to be developed. The ATS, the Travel Authorization System for visa-exempted nationals, will be operational this year. The entry-exit system will record and store data on every person moving around the entering and leaving the Schengen territory. And the ECRIS third country nationals is a criminal record system, national central database, which is I'm quite concerned about, because the member states can submit records, criminal records, or the third country nationals with criminal records in any member state. We don't have such large-scale databases on EU citizens. And I quite much agree with Julia, it's indiscriminate large-scale data collection and storage on third country nationals only. And this is it is worrying because of the inaccuracies of the unlegal basis, because also there's a lot of discretionary power for member states to decide, okay, which third country national, what do we want to report in the Schengen information system, for example? Do they keep up the data retention periods? There can be inaccuracies with the name. And of course, the effect is huge. If you're in the system and it says you're not allowed to enter or you have overstayed your visa, you will be kicked out immediately because of the strict application of those databases. And I don't know whether if you remember, there was an issue on the Kozlovska and third country national who was active in Poland, amongst others, and she was entered by the Polish authorities. And it was there was a suspicion that was more political entry ban. And she flew to Brussels for her meetings and she was kicked out immediately. Only years later, because of her connections with the European Parliament, she talked before the German Parliament, many high officials were active for her case. So the Polish entry ban had to be withdrawn. And her case showed the possible misuse, for example, by the Schengen information system. So this is to stress that those databases, the Schengen information system for this discretionary power, but also in connection with the large-scale databases, really includes a lot of concerns with regard to indiscriminate storage, but also the possible misuse, but also the connection between databases so that when there's an inaccuracy, it will multiple this mistakes. And then second, what also Julien just mentioned, the fact that risk assessments will be based, and this is also new technology because of we have a lot of data on third country nationals, they are combined. So we make risk assessment, and those risk assessments or profiles on third country nationals will be used again in visa policies. And in ATIAS, there's law already, the European Travel Authorization System includes the use of risk assessment for deciding whether you will receive a travel authorization or not. And here we have a problem, of course, not only of reliability of data and information based for immigration decisions, but also the fact how to appeal against such a decision. And both this, and maybe I can address that in the next question, but it is already, I want already to stress there's important case of the Court of Justice, both in the framework of data protection, protecting individuals against data processing, as in the context of immigration law policies, like in visa decisions. And when you look at that case law, there are important limitations and safeguards to be respected by the member states when using those large-scale databases. And to be honest, and that's maybe also what Julien meant with the indiscriminate nature of the storage on data on third country nationals at the moment, I think when we have a case started before the Court of Justice dealing with the legitimacy of the storage on third country nationals at this moment and what member states and authorities, Europol, Frontex can do with that information, I think that the legislator might have a problem, that the Court of Justice will just say, this is not effective, this is not proportional, this is not protecting the rights of the third country nationals sufficiently. But that's a guess because these procedures still have to be started.
And if I may add one point to what Evelyn has been saying, it is already quite difficult also to keep track of who has access to the system. So imagine when everything becomes interoperable, it's going to be even trickier. So to give you an example, this is an old example from the EU Lisa's assessment of the functioning of the visa information system. It was published the report I'm referring to was published in 2018. And it was quite striking because essentially in 2018, what EU Lisa reported is that you had approximately 500,000 officials in the EU and Schengen, among EU Schengen states, that had potential access to the visa information system under the VIS regulation. So, which means for border management and migration enforcement purposes, as well as to some extent for asylum procedures. And what is striking also is that, for example, some of the replies of the member states to the questions that were asked by Yulisa about who had access. So, for example, the German authorities did not even bother to provide an update. At the time, the French authorities said that there were approximately 80,000 officials who had access. Literally, it says approximately 80,000 officials. And for those member states who were very thorough and provided clear information, for example, the Polish government reported that officials from three officials from the military counterintelligence service and two officials from the government protection bureaus, which are security and intelligence services, had access to the VIS under the border and migration enforcement aspect of the system, right? So, and I think it's, you know, why not? You can imagine that as long as there's a proper framework in place, you could give that kind of access. But at the same time, it raises a number of questions, right? 500,000 people within the EU and Schengen area have access to quite sensitive data. And of course, the technology allows you, for example, to create logs so that you can know automatically, you can register who has been accessing the data at what point. But that's, you know, if it's only one system, I can imagine how it can work. If we're talking about interoperable systems, so access to all of the systems through the European single portal, as it is now called, the Google of these databases, to put it that way, I'm not sure it's the right analogy, but that becomes complicated, and kind of enforcement of the limitations of access for data protection authorities, both national and the European data protection supervisor, becomes a daunting task, right? So this is also something that must be kept in mind when we're talking about these systems and their uses.
Oh, thank you. Our members also have questions.
Hello, I do have a question regarding the EU Fundamental Rights Agency release a report called Under Watchful Eyes, Biometrics, EU IT Systems, and Fundamental Rights in 2018. So regarding this report, there was an opinion saying that to support the detection of missing children or child victims of trafficking in human beings, EU member states needed to record missing children systematically in CIS2 to ensure that the data stored are used for child protection purpose and not only for law enforcement. EU member states needed to put in place effective cooperation mechanisms between police and child protection authorities, as well as guardians. So I would like to ask, Robert, do you think that CIS2 would be the best database to support the detection of missing children? And how could it differentiate cases related to human trafficking and those concerning child fleeing from abuse, such as domestic violence, for example? And regarding the right to information and exceptions foreseen in the CIS2 regulation, how could we ensure this right for children within the implementation of CIS2? Thank you in advance.
Thank you, Emily. This is a good question because it also points out to the original purpose and setup of the Schengen Information System, which was not wrong at all. Certainly, if you combine it with the new databases we just discussed and their indefinite purpose, and I can explain that. The Schengen Information System is a quite sectional database in the sense I always refer to the German word informationelle Gewaltenteilung or informational division of powers. So it was when it was developed that, for example, alerts on third country nationals would only be accessible for immigration and border guards, European arrest warrant for judicial authorities, and for example, information on missing children, whether abducted or victim of human trafficking by judicial or police authorities. So I think that is a good purpose. And I saw also that some NGOs who are trying to like Fundamental Rights Agency, but also national governmental NGOs dealing with the protection of missing children say that there should be done more and exchange of data, because it is of course very important, looking at the open borders of Schengen, that police authorities cooperate in time to detect missing children. And there is also a provision that you have two regulations, not in fact more regulations, but one regulation on law enforcement use of the Schengen information system and the other on the border and immigration law use. And the category of missing children is provided for in the law enforcement regulation, and also differentiating between not differentiating, but seeing that it is important to report missing children, whether they are in risk of being abducted by their parents or human trafficking. There could be a concern that, but I'm not an expert in this particular category of missing children and whether it's effectively used. There could be a misuse in the sense that border guard authorities already report unaccompanied minor asylum seekers to have them in the Schengen information system. But to be honest, the category is only to be used to see by law enforcement authorities to check whether the person is searched for in one of the other countries. And looking at the numbers, you have the reports of EOLISA, the agency who controls large-scale databases. It reports that in 2020, only 116,000 missing children have been reported. I'm not sure whether that is an effective use, whether more children are lost. The question is it effectively used? Are really national authorities relying on the data which is in the Schengen information system? And in my experience with the Schengen information system, for example, also reports on third country nationals, it's not always clear whether the national authorities trust the information which is in the system. And I agree, it's quite important to have more research about that and what happens and how many. And there, for all the categories in the Schengen information system, information is missing on the effectiveness, both with regard to European arrest warrants, with regard to perceived terrorists, with regard to third country nationals. We always get reports from EOLISA on the numbers of data and how many searches there have been. There were really millions and millions searches every year on Schengen information system, but not whether it leads to the concrete result in finding people, or how many expulsion of third country nationals, or how many children could be brought back to their parents or one of the parents in case of abduction. And with regard to your question on the rights, I think of course with minor children it's difficult to ask permission if the child is lost, and the data protection regulation provides, and that should be obeyed also in this part, there's specific protection on children beyond 16 or 13 years. Member states can lower that. And if there's no permission from the parents, there should be specific guarantees, and always the data storage should be in the best interest of the child, also respecting Article 24 of the Charter. And one other thing in connection to this, what concerns me, the Schengen information system is really specifically framed to help missing children to be found. In my work as a researcher, I've been confronted that the purpose of protecting the interests of missing children has been misused in my eyes to lower the age for storing data in Eurodac, which is now proposed to lower to 6, and in the visum information system, which is already lowered to 6 years. So it used to be 14 years before. So children who travel with their parents as an asylum seeker or as a visa applicant, because they want to visit the Schengen area, already from the age of 6 years, they have to provide their fingerprints, and they will be stored for long term in those databases as well. And not, well, the European Commission every time said that it's useful to have data on children in those databases as well, for example, if they get lost. But that's ridiculous, because you have already the Schengen information system. And here you see a sort of policy, which is quite often the case, that they say, well, we need this database as well. Like, for example, the ECRIS, the European Criminal Record System on Third Country Nationals. They say, well, we need that because we need to have to know that third country nationals have been convicted. But you have already the Schengen Information System for that purpose, if it's relevant for immigration law. And you have criminal records, you could ask via European arrest warrant, or if it's relevant, you could also use the Schengen Information System. And with children, and I remember also in European Parliament when we were asking about this as researchers, well, why would it be more efficient to lower the age in Eurodac? And what the member states want in the European Commission is some as much as data, including children, and keep the data for restrictive immigration policy purposes. And that, I hope it answers a little bit your question.
I have a question for Professor Jean Desbault. So in the article, you co-author the EU and its counterterrorism policies after the Paris attacks. To what extent do you think that the counterterrorism tools used by the EU have evolved in the sense of discreteness? Do you think there's some divergence between how the EU expresses its concern towards data protection also established in recent EU regulations and how it's, as referred in the article, that the EU internal security cooperation calls for more storage, sharing, and processing of data?
Thank you, Victoria. I think so. It's two questions in one, really. The first one refers to what we were calling at the time discreteness. And what we were referring to was the fact that for most of the 90s and early 2000s, outside of a specialized kind of audience and group of people, the development of these information systems was not something that was very, very publicized. Not that it was secret, but it was not something that was debated on the main political stages of the EU institutions, right? And what has changed in the last decade or so is that this is very much now in the forefront. I mean, a few years back, you had President Juncker of the European Commission saying in his State of the Union address that European Union wanted to make sure that every person who crossed the external borders of the European Union would be known, would have an electronic record attached to them, right? And you see these acronyms that we've been talking about, SIS, VIS, ATIS. Now you see them in political debate, including recently in the French presidential election debate, where one candidate accused the current president of not doing enough when it comes to checking people against SIS, right? So it erupts on the political stage in a way that was not the case before. So and counterterrorism has played a big role in this because it has the deployment of info systems has been framed as a response to the attacks of 2015 and 2016 in Paris and Brussels in particular. And so that's one aspect, right? The second aspect is your question about data protection. Now, I have to say, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a legal scholar, and I'm not a data protection expert. So, and I'm looking at Evelyn while I'm saying this because she is outstanding in both areas. What is important, I think, is for me, the way I understand it is that data protection is about regulating the processing of personal data, right? So data protection essentially tells you, if you want to process this data, here's the rules and the conditions that you have to observe. So data protection is not necessarily an obstacle to data processing. It says, here are the rules that need to be followed. So to some extent, you could argue the fact that you are able to have data protection provisions with regard, and they're everywhere, and they're in every single instrument related to these info systems, enables data processing, right? And very few cases come to mind where data protection authorities have said, no way, you can't do this, because that's not their role as well. The one case that is unrelated to the current discussion that I have in mind is very recent. It's the request from the European Data Protection Supervisor that Europol deletes its unlawfully acquired database. It was called the data arc, right? So it's petabytes of data that Europol acquired during investigations and that was called while coordinating investigations. And that was unlawfully acquired. So this is one of the few cases where that I have in mind, where the data protection authority said, this, you can't do this. Like, this is not possible, and this is unlawful. So I think you have to keep that in mind, that it's not necessarily that data protection is the opposite of data processing. And that's a really, really important aspect to understand why there are, in fact, data protection provisions in all of these instruments and that accompany every single one of these information systems. I think Evelyn might want to jump in on this one as well.
I have a question for...
Could I join or address a little bit of data protection? Because I think that's a very important question, that the different rules on the large-scale databases, as we just described, including the interoperability mechanism, all include data protection rules referring to the Law Enforcement Directive or the GDPR. And a purpose of why the data is used, the data access rights, the overview by independent data protection supervisor. So that all seems in order, and also data security, which is quite important. But maybe two comments and concerns. That first, and this is also what I explained to my students, and I've written about that, the purpose of purpose limitation. We should not make the mistake that the purpose limitation is a quite important a classic data protection principle. This is not only about data specification, but data limitation to only that what you need for your goal, for your aim of your work. And so again, this indiscriminate nature of the current data collection we have in Europe on third country nationals, allowing databases set up for immigration or asylum purposes now being used for law enforcement and national security purposes, and vice versa, a criminal record system which may be used by national authorities for immigration law purposes. This is not, even if you write it down in your European legislation, this is not sufficient for purpose limitation. Always is the goal and the test, and this will be applied in future, I'm sure, by the European Court of Justice, is it strictly necessary? And that is second. So this purpose specification, you can have questions about that. It should include the effectiveness and the necessity, and that is not sufficient at the moment, in my view. And second, and this is also what Julia already raised, the fact by interoperability, it's no longer clear who is a user or who reported the data, who entered the data. And this is not, of course, a problem for the third country national, the individual, but also for the users and for the data protection authorities, not knowing anymore which law does apply. So the data protection laws become complex because it's no longer clear should we apply the rules of the specific legal instrument on the database or the rules of the GDPR because it concerns immigration law use, or the rules of the Law Enforcement Directive, because there's law enforcement use involved. And data protection authorities, the fundamental rights agency, the EDPS, has over time, every time when amendments were discussed by the parliament or where a new proposal for a new large-scale database was submitted, addressed that point of lack of transparency on the applicable laws on data protection, but also the lack of power for data protection authorities. They simply don't have enough staff, money to do all those tasks to supervise, aside from all the other general controlling tasks, also considering these large-scale databases. So that is a problem from the data protection law.
Thank you both. Go ahead, Priscilla.
I have a question for Professor Brouwer. Regarding the legal protection of third country nationals, I would like to ask if you suggest other improvements to the current CIS2.
No, thank you, Priscilla. That's a good question. To be honest, and this is, I addressed that already in my thesis in 2007. I'm really happy that provision has not been changed. There is, in fact, a quite strong protection of legal remedies in the CIS2 regulation, which already was in the Schengen Convention before that, which is that first you can have, if you want to change or you want to access or change the data which is in the Schengen information system, you have the right to go to every member state to have that data checked and possibly changed, amended. And the court can ask every other member state to do so. So there's this obligation of mutual enforcement of national court decisions on the accuracy or the inaccuracy of data. In practice, it's not often used. A German court or a Dutch court or a Portuguese court will not feel very confident in saying to a French authorities or Polish authorities, you have to change that information in the Schengen information system. And therefore, it should be more aware that first, third country nationals have that right of appeal against the CIS alerts, but also courts and data protection authorities to offer that protection, even cross-border. And the second important protection, which is recently included in the Schengen Information System regulation, is you have a right to appeal against a refusal, visa refusal, entry refusal, based on Schengen Information System. So there are strong rights. And in the Schengen Borders Code and the Visa Code, you have also the right to legal appeal. And that is what I meant with also the case law of the Court of Justice dealing with right to effective judicial protection, which is a fundamental right, 47 of the Charter. And the Court of Justice many times said, even if member states have national discretionary power, such as in immigration policies, you have to respect the right to effective judicial protection. And this is really important and will lead to, I hope, case law in future, because when you are confronted with a decision based on one of those databases or on risk assessment algorithms, you have the right to know the basis, and the member state refusing entry or visa should inform you about the reasons, should really adapt the legal procedures to provide you that right to access to effective remedies. So on paper, it's really strong. It is the member state, and in case law as well, and the member states now really should know that they cannot use their databases which have these effects for third country nationals without offering effective judicial protection.
Thank you. And Professor Jean de Beau, do you have other suggestions too for the improvement of CIS too?
No, at this point, I mean, to be very honest, I think even for us, we've been following this. The last few years have been quite overwhelming in terms of everything that has happened. One observation I have, but maybe Evelyn has more thoughts on this than I do. It is about interoperability and the fact that interoperability also creates very specific modules that look like information systems, but whose the status of which we're very unclear about. And that's the common identity repository, which is supposed to be this kind of warehouse where identity data from different systems is stored, and also the biometric matching system, which is the module that enables comparison between biometric data coming from, I don't know, a border checkpoint and biometric data stored in one of these systems. Because in the BMS, what you do have storage, and these are biometric models, right? They're not the full picture of a fingerprint or a face. They're essentially it's essentially a model of the biometric feature that you're measuring. And so there, the question is, you know, are these information systems? Should there be? And I'm sure about this. The extent to which there's specific data protection provisions for those, and how as a data subject, it becomes possible for me to ask for changes to be made to the data that is stored in there. But maybe this is something that Evelyn has worked on or knows more about than I do.
No, it's a really good point, Julien, because that will really makes it less transparent also for the users, and not only the individuals which might be confronted with those data and data analysis and finally a refusal of entry, because that is of course what is at stake here, not at such the databases, but the fact it can decide on your future, whether you get refugee protection or whether you get a visa, which normally you should have received, or the allowance of to enter the Schengen territory. And I'm now looking for her name, Dimitrova. She defended her thesis in Brussels and exactly on this point, the right to access of information and the fact that this is so obscured by this interim mechanisms due to the scheme of interoperability. And this is a law to be developed by the Court of Justice and data protection authorities as well. But where do you start to talk about personal information, or where do you start about the combination or the risk assessment? And in this regard, we also have to take a look at the development of the AI Act or the proposal on the regulation on the use of artificial intelligence. And Paul de Hertz, also VUB, he wrote, I think a year ago, on the effect on the prohibition we have now in the GDPR on automated decision making. And this also relates a little bit on this use of interoperability, in the fact that, yes, we have a prohibition of automated decision making in the sense it cannot be the databases who inform a decision which directly affect the legal status or interests of an individual. But it is with a lot of exceptions. So I personally, I don't agree at all with the current text in the GDPR, because it allows member states and also enterprises to use a lot of risk assessment for their decision making. So I think that should definitely be improved, not only for the Schengen Information System, but in general. And to be honest, I think that it should be done in the GDPR, but the AI Act, so the proposal on artificial intelligence, must be in a combination. It should not be that the Artificial Intelligence Act allows one thing and the GDPR should prohibit it. But now the current regulation in the GDPR is not sufficient. And I'm quite concerned about the AI Act, because it seems more that the European Commission and now all the lobby organizations are more interested that the AI Act will allow more than to what is the goal is to prevent fundamental rights when artificial intelligence is being used. So also outside of the immigration and law territory. Now, I'm really concerned, and this is really what I wanted also to address in this podcast, because it allows the use of polygraphs, especially in the framework of asylum and migration database. So the AI Act proposal includes a provision, and also in the annex of the proposal, it is allowed that, yes, polygraphs or lie detectors are considered as high-risk systems and therefore should be with specific safeguards. But the worrying thing is that it doesn't prohibit the use of lie detectors. No, it allows it as long as there are safeguards, and it specifically mentions the possible use of lie detectors in the framework of immigration and law decisions and asylum decisions. So possibly also to see whether an asylum claim is credible, and also in the area of law enforcement. And this is really a worrying proposal, because we already know that the European Commission funded a project, I Border Control, investigating whether lie detectors would be visible. So really talking about border avatars, checking whether you could check with psychological and physical images whether a visa applicant or an entry authorization applicant tells the truth about his or her intended visit to the Schengen area. And this is, yeah, in my view, and we many lawyers, many NGOs, the fundamental rights agencies have warned for this advanced use of lie detectors, because we should not go in that area, because then we have a problem: data protection, legal remedies, and fundamental rights, and stigmatization also of third country nationals.
Thank you both.
Brouwer, in your article, Digital Borders and Real Rights, do you think the pandemic has affected positively or negatively the six criteria discussed by Bowles to maximize the effective legal remedies? And in either case, if so, what lessons do you think can be taken into account to improve the way in which the EU proceeds with migration?
I'm not so sure if I understand this question. So I think you refer to my thesis, Digital Rights and Real
Digital Borders and Real Rights, exactly.
2008. And yes, that the goal of my thesis then at that time was really to define the right to legal remedies, both in data protection law and immigration law. And as I just mentioned before, on paper, that is quite, the Schengen Information System as a regulation is quite exemplary in the sense of on paper, there are strong rights for third country nationals, both with regard to the data stored in the Schengen Information System as the decisions which can be based on Schengen Information System. So it is only the member states and the courts who should use, and of course third country nationals who should know about their rights, and they must be informed. And then of course the courts and the states really respecting that right to effective judicial protection. I'm not sure that the pandemic really changed, aside from the new feature that aside from this, which we discussed today, and I already, the not only prevention of irregular risk, but the very emphasis on security purposes of the databases since the terrorist attacks in the United States, but also in Europe. And now we have, of course, the health risk. They have, of course, the borders closed. So it's more with regard to the use of border controls and the internal border controls that I think the pandemic will have changes. The databases can already be used, like the Schengen Information System, to report possible persons to be refused entry because of health risks. I'm not sure, possibly there will be new developments, but as Julien said, the last few years have been overwhelming already with proposals to extend the information, the storage of information, exchange of information. Maybe the European Commission first wants this. We have now three databases already functioning, the Visa Information System, Eurodac and SIS. Three have to be made operational. I think European Commission and the member states are already having a hard time to to get it technologically and also maybe financially done. I don't know whether health risks will be from the point of view on storing data and using data a new development. Maybe Julia knows, has other information on that point, on the relation with pandemic and?
Well, so in the regulation on the European Travel Information and Authorization System, there's a part of the questionnaire that applicants for pre-travel authorization need to fill in that relates to health. And that was influenced in my memory by concerns at the time, it was with Ebola in particular. So there was a whole debate about the risk of Ebola escaping the region where it is endemic. And kind of the justification was, well, we need to have public health provisions in there. I think during the pandemic, and going back to your point about intra-Schengen travel, there was at one point a temptation to use the passenger name record data framework, so the PNR directive, to be able to trace the travels of persons within the Schengen area coming in and out of areas of particular pandemic concern, so areas in red or orange, depending on the rules in place in the country at the given time. But this was not used as much, also because there's no provision for related to health in the PNR directive and in national transposing laws. So it was too complicated. Certainly there was a temptation at some point. But for me, the ETIAS is the one where there is, with regard to third country nationals and travels from outside of the EU, where there is this public health dimension that is quite important. And ETIAS is important because it addresses people who do not need a visa to enter the EU. So people who are not registered in the visa information system, they will be in ETIAS. So that was what I had in mind about this.
Yeah, that's, and of course, in the visa information system, if you're refused a visa because of health reasons, it will all be also be reported. And in that case, I think you're right, Julia, because we already addressed that, that all those data, the big data, will be used for risk assessment. In future, I'm sure that, that border guards or migration officials or health officials will be thinking about, okay, can we now use all those databases also to allow or to preview or to consider where health risks are coming and where we should maybe refuse a visa or ATS and a travel authorization from two people specifically coming from that area. So in that sense, I think pandemic will influence both the use of data and the use of risk assessments.
Thank you.
One last question, Professor Jean de Boe. The origin of the CIS is linked to the idea of Europe without borders and the concern for freedom of movement and security. With the war in Syria and the 2015 crisis, security-related discourse grew and some Schengen states began to reintroduce internal border controls. Today, with the Russo-Ukrainian war, we do not listen to the same speech. How is the situation in 2015 different from the current one? Is it possible to say that there is a double standard?
Thank you for your question, Priscilla. I think the answer is already in the question, right? Yes, clearly the response is different, and I think what is striking with the current situation is that the Commission and the Member States did something that I don't know about Evelyn, but personally I did not expect them to do, which is to activate the Temporary Protection Directive. So, which is an instrument that is 20 years old, that was never used, and that the Commission recently said was obsolete. And all of a sudden, within 2 days, the Commission proposed to use the directive. And I think it was on 4th March or something like this, the Council unanimously voted to apply it. And that's, I mean, it's fantastic news because it means that it gives Ukrainian nationals access to temporary residence permits, to emergency healthcare, to shelter, emergency shelter, social benefits, and limited access to the labor market. And that's fantastic news because, you know, clearly there is that this was typically a situation that the directive was meant to address. Now, of course, there's question marks as always. One of them is that this only applies to Ukrainian nationals and persons who benefit from international protection in Ukraine, but does not apply to other third country nationals who might be lawfully residing or unlawfully residing actually in Ukraine. So it means that, you know, the double standard, so to speak, is still there in a lot of ways. I think, and that was I was reading this. It's in the it's the immigration and law blog. It's one of our colleague from Suleyman Demirel University in Turkey. And what essentially she was pointing out as well is that in any case, most Ukrainian nationals who have a biometric passport can already travel visa-free to the European Union. So there was no way for anyone to justify pushbacks and kind of detention at the border in the way that it was done in 2015 with Syrian nationals. And if one is inclined to be cynical, which we shouldn't, there's also no buffer country, right? There's no third country like Turkey between Ukraine and the Schengen area. And that, you know, makes the political options here more limited. But I think, you know, it's amazing that the directive was activated, and let's hope that this, you know, it will make it very difficult in the future for the member states and the Commission to say that they will not activate the directive for the next one, because there will be other moments where this question arises as well. But you can see also how this connects to the discussion we've just had, right? Because this is also a question about the fact that Ukrainian nationals, because they have biometric passports, even though this biometric data is not available to European authorities, there's still something here which has to do with the possibility of identifying these persons, of keeping track to some extent of their activities and whereabouts.
Thank you. And with this last thought, we come to the end of our episode. Thanks again for the brilliant and insightful participation of our guests, Jean de Boer and Brouwer. To our followers, thank you for listening. And stay tuned for upcoming episodes of our podcast and the initiatives of our research team on social media and on the Nova Refugee Clinic Legal Clinic website. See you in the next episode.